Okay, dear friends and colleagues, welcome to another meeting of the Sufi Studies Network. And it's my real great pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Ashkan Bahrani is joining us from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Ashkan earned his bachelor's degree in law and master's degree in philosophy and theology at Shiraz University. And currently he is a PhD candidate about to defend his dissertation at Vanderbilt University. The title of his dissertation is Sufi Debates between the 9th to 15th centuries. Ashkan has widely published in religious studies, Islamic studies, but also broadly in religious studies. His publications include an award-winning Persian book titled Ayine Haye Nisti, The Mirrors of Nothingness, that was comparing Meister Eckhart and Rumi from the perspective of negative theology. And he has also award-winning translations, Persian translations of important works, such as Ahmed Kara Mustafa's Sufism in the Formative Period, and Vincent Brumer's What Are We Doing When We Are Praying? And he has additional publications on Abdul Karim Suruj, a forthcoming book to be published by New York University Press, and a book on Omar Suhrawardi to be published by Brill. So very quick introduction. It's my real pleasure to introduce Ashkan and his talk. The talk will feature a neologism that he has recently coined. It's persophilia, and the title of his talk is Decolonizing Persophilia. So once again, welcome, dear Ashkan, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Aydoğan, for your generous and kind introduction, and thank you everybody for being here today. It's a great pleasure to be part of the monthly presentations. Yeah, as Aydoğan mentioned, the title of my presentation today is Decolonizing Persophilia, with the subtitle Academic Violence in the Study of Persian and Sufism in North America. This is actually part or a chapter of my dissertation, in what follows, I'm trying to provide you with a summary of what I have done in this chapter. I'd like to start with two quick introductory remarks regarding two new terms, and then I'll move on and jump into the body of the paper. I think it's not a bad idea if I start with the terms, the so-called coinages. One is persophilia and the other is academic violence. I just need to explain that by persophilia, which is a combination of persophilia and of course Sufism, I mean a kind of intense and let's say very passionate academic interest into a combination of Persian literature and Sufism, or the juxtaposition of Persian literature and Sufism that we can find both in the North American Academy in the second half of the 20th century, and of course in the first decades of the 21st century, but also we can find such an interest in the 19th century and early 20th century Orientalist scholarship among European scholars of Islam and Sufism. So this is the first thing that I wanted to elaborate. The other thing is the notion of academic violence. What I mean by academic violence is a kind of a potent cocktail, which is comprised of epistemic, institutional, and structural coercion, and at times imposition, and in the which is intensified, which has been intensified in the first in the 20th century and 21st century in the, let's say, in the most intense cases, we can talk about violence, a kind of epistemic, institutional and structural violence in the academy. That's why I prefer to call it academic violence. And before I move on to my main argument, I just want to let you know that by violence, I have adopted and I have borrowed Franz Fanon's classical definition of violence, acts and actions against a human's personality and integrity that can be manifested in different levels. As Fanon mentions, violence is a multifaceted and multi-layer phenomenon. Today, I'll focus on the epistemic and institutional aspects of violence in the study of Sufism. And in this study, I have focused on the last 50 years of scholarship very quickly from the 1970s until present time in American universities and a few Canadian universities that have Islamic studies programs. My main argument is that through different trends stemming from various categorizations and polythetic taxonomies, what we can name neo-Eurocentrism has been perpetually preserved and reloaded in academic curricula under the guises of persophilia, istoxication, and perennialism. In this study, I have categorized the scholars of Islamic studies and the scholars of Sufism in North America into three major trends, three discernible trends in the study of Sufism. The first trend could be called essentialist textualist approach, which is exemplified by the late Anna Marishimo, Sayyid Hossein Nasser, and to a lesser degree, William Chivik. The second trend can be called historical textualist approach, which is illustrated by Marshall Hodgson, Ahmed Kara Mustafa, Alexander Kenish, and Michael Sells. And the third trend, which could be called historical anthropological approach to Sufism, is represented among others by Carl Ernst and Hamid Dabashi. I would like to continue with two quick disclaimers. The first disclaimer is these major trends do not arise from, as you can see, these major trends do not arise from a monothetic Aristotelian taxonomy. In other words, they are not species of the same genus. Rather, they have been embodied by temporary juxtapositions and occasional alliances of different approaches to the study of religion. And the second disclaimer, which is a kind of moral or ethical disclaimer, that I would like to emphasize that by this critical overview, I want to, let's say, underestimate or undermine the huge contribution that these exemplary figures have made to the study of Islam in the present time. This is just a kind of, let's say, on the one hand, when we talk about Carl Ernst and Hamid Dabashi, it could be a kind of internal critic from a post-colonial approach. And on the other, I think without further investigation in the history of the study of Sufism in the last 50 years, by focusing on some great figures like Annemarie Schimmel or Michael Sells, we cannot move on and see what we can do as students of the study of religion as their immediate or immediate students, or let's say as their students in general. So I think I have to clarify this from the very beginning. So as we can see, the platform is a hybrid platform, and there are always mutual impact between North American Academy on the one hand and the Academy and the, let's say, public sphere in countries like Iran and Afghanistan. There are always exchange of knowledge and exchange of scholars between these two platforms, and this makes the situation even more complex. For example, when it comes to some figures who have originally come from countries like Iran, Afghanistan, Turkey, India, or Pakistan. And what makes this classification more complex is the commonality of social functions, public proclivities, and political platforms. If I want to bring just a couple of instances, for example, we can find the issue of proselytization in the Academy among different figures in different trends. For example, we can find them among some essentialist textualists who proselytize Islam or proselytize their understanding of Sufism in the Academy. And of course, we can find some other figures who do the same thing among the other trends, like in among the historical textualists. Analysts and scholars. This study addresses the confrontation of two manifestations of non-corporeal violence in American academy. The neocolonial violence predominantly propagated by some politically conservative academic institutions versus reactionary, tribalistic, and regionalistic violence and politically motivated violence that is orchestrated by some of the representatives of post-colonial anti-colonial studies, based on what we borrow from Franz Fanon, we can superimpose these two kinds of violence in the study of Sufism in North American academy. And as I've mentioned briefly earlier, the theoretical framework of this study is predominantly built upon the works of some post-colonial and subaltern scholars and subaltern inquiries. The work The Rest of the Earth by Franz Fanon stands out, and also I have tried to benefit from the works of Tomoko Masuzawa, Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, Richard King, and Dipesh Chakrabarty. Now I'd like to jump into the first category, first trend of scholars in the study of Sufism, i.e. essentialist textualists. I think it is very telling that the tradition of essentialist textualistic scholars of Sufism in the United States begin with the German scholar Anna-Marie Schimmel, who migrated to the United States and settled at Harvard University in the mid-1970s. She was a sublime exemplum of the continuation of European Orientalist scholarship in America. Schimmel's academic tradition of the study of Sufism, which very briefly, I just point to three issues about Schimmel's scholarship. First of all, her understanding of Sufism, as we all know, is predominantly individualized and psychologized. Throughout her work, individual experiences and ideations are clearly privileged over communal practice and institution building. And interestingly enough, it is camouflage, or sometimes there are some camouflage or dormant Protestant Western European presumptions widespread in her oeuvre. The second point is her dependence upon cryptic theological and medieval Christian vocabulary in her treatment of Sufism. It is interesting that she examines, evaluates, and valorizes the Sufi subject matter through lenses offered by medieval Christian mystical theology, wherein her speculations about Islamic mystical tradition take up the impossible mission, I believe that it's an impossible mission, of describing Sufi heritage with phrases such as via purgativa, via illuminative, unio mystica, visio beatifica, and so on and so forth. And the third point that we can see in her works is her assessment of the Sufi path and Sufi orders, which is also understood as part and parcel of a broader project, which is laid down in the discourse of world religions, framed by the components of Christian-based science of comparative theology in the quotation mark. The second scholar in the next generation is William Chittick, which belongs to the generation who started his scholarship in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And the impact of Eliadian and Corbinian scholarship is preserved by and large in his work. Of course, we cannot deny that his bulk of scholarship is, of course, to some degree, is hybrid, based on the scholarship that he receives at Tehran University in his doctoral program, and nonetheless, what we can find as something ubiquitous in his works is the way he introduces readers to primary sources. The way he introduces readers to primary sources about Sufism is predominantly Eurocentric, unmistakably reminiscent of the 19th century presumption and framings based on comparative philology and comparative theology. And this is obvious in some of his works about Ibn Arabi, but most importantly, it is clear in his Sufism, a beginner's guide, which of course addresses the Western readers. essentialist and textualist in his scholarship. Among the second trend, the historical textualists, we can talk about the second volume of Marshall Hodgson's Venture of Islam, which inspects the establishment of an international Islamic civilization. Without a doubt, the work was written against the mainstream North Atlantic Eurocentric historiographies within the context of European, but it is within the context of European universalist historiography, and it's notions, thanks to his innovative terminology.
Dear Ashkan, there was just a few seconds when we lost connection with you, but I think we are still on track, so you can continue as you wish.
Okay, sorry about the interruption.
Hopefully, that's fine. We can clarify later in the Q&A session.
Sure. With Persian and Persianate, we have a kind of somehow, let's say, marginalized but still very helpful term like Nile Axis instead of the Middle East, with which we can stay away from a predominantly Eurocentric vocabulary. Nonetheless, and despite all of these innovative efforts to decenter European history, I think Hodgson cannot and purportedly does not want to detach completely from the two major discursive formations of othering, and namely that of world religions and world history. If we move forward to the present time, I think one of the major hairs of Hodgson's scholarship in the study of Sufism is Alexander Kenish. Kenish has a specific stance in this category. He takes part in a self-reflexive analysis of the discourse of Sufism as an Orientalist discourse. And that makes Kenish perhaps an unapologetic application and advocacy of the historical textualist approach in a modernist fashion in making sense of an innately pre-modern non-European sociocultural phenomenon under an invented designation, which is Sufism. Unlike his fellow historians of Sufism, who are typically reserved and silent about the post-colonial critic of Sufism's historiography in the contemporary academy, Kenish challenges his post-colonialist colleagues, offering counter-critics to their critic of the Orientalist tradition. Kenish deals with the change of assumptions about Sufism as the ascetic mystical stream in Islam and its imagination in different societies. Unlike them, however, he does not issue an indictment against the Orientalist scholarship as far as I could trace. Quite on the contrary, he absolves his Orientalist predecessors of the charges suggested by, quote, quote, Carl Ernst and his students. In his opinion, the European, Russian, and later American Orientalists are as crucial and constructive in shaping the edifice of Sufism, its storehouse of information, and its epistemic apparatus as their indigenous colleagues. So that's why I think among this trend and this category, Alexander Kenish stands out and deserves a full consideration. Kenish, however, and dismisses the influence of lenses and the dominance of regimes of truth specific to European and Russian scholarly systems. Quote, modicum of objectivity.
Ashkan, I think we missed only the last maybe 3-4 sentences. We can repeat them, that will be lovely. Sure. Sorry for that.
Sure. Yeah, again, sorry for the interruption. Kenish, however, dismissed the influence of lenses and the dominance of regimes of truth specific to European and Russian scholarly systems, which have imprinted themselves on the study of other cultures and traditions. And even more problematically, he's quite optimistic about achieving a quote-unquote modicum of objectivity. And it neglects the role that positionality plays for every researcher. If I want to expedite and move on quickly to this third, to the third category. Historical anthropologists are maybe the last generations of scholars of Sufism who come on scene in the United States. This trend is considerably more conscious of the role that the political plays in the making of the lenses through which the human beings engaged with Sufism have been investigated. Among these, as I've said, I have focused on Carl Ernst and Hamid Dabashi. With regard to the latter, I have focused on those works that have something to do directly with Sufism. Ernst endeavors to cover a wide range of understanding related to the practice of Sufism. On the one side of the spectrum, some Sufi chains and orders identify themselves with Islam's proper practice, for them being observant of Islamic law, conventional Islamic rituals, and Islamic jurisprudence is vital. On the other side of the spectrum lies a universalist, spiritualist approach to Sufism. It is worth noting that Ernst tries to cover this wide range of spectrum. Despite his innovative anthropological approach to the history of Sufism, the historical trajectory Ernst suggests for the development of Sufism from the formative period to the present suffers from selective amnesia and sometimes simplistic evaluation. Plus, his critique of Orientalist reason does not lead to a new playing field devoid of Eurocentric tools or toolbox. His awareness of the Eurocentric and Protestant-minded approach to the study of Sufism in North America does not free him from Eurocentric expectations when observing the history of Sufism. And so I think that's also the case with Debashi, and they're almost on the same page with regard to the way that they use the toolbox and they approach the history of Sufism. What I can add about Debashi is, again, borrowing Franz Fanon's definition of violence, we can find a kind of reactionary violence in the works of Debashi, and at the same time, he preserves some Eurocentric lenses through which he can compare the past with the present. That's one thing that we can find in Debashi, and we cannot find it necessarily in the works of Ernst. The last part of the paper works on the notion of academic violence in further details. In this part, I have tried to compare two rival understandings of epistemic violence. One is represented by Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak, which I can call the more gloomy and pessimistic, which focuses on the notion of native informants and the way that this newly constructed notion of native informant may mislead us, to quote her, provides an apparently nativist understanding of the colonial and quasi-colonial societies. On the other part of the spectrum, we can find Richard King, who is more optimistic about the acquirement of the native or the nativist knowledge. And it is interesting that time and again, Richard King quotes Spivak to criticize her pessimism with regard to the possibility of acquiring a kind of indigenous knowledge. My argument in this part is that new Eurocentrism in American academia has fashioned peculiar technologies of power. In this, I would side with Spivak rather than King, including complicated bureaucratic and economical devices, and it controls and manipulates the pace and course of producing knowledge in the study of Iranian Sufism or Persian Sufism. As Fanon himself puts it, decolonization is always a violent phenomenon, and we can find this violence in two ways. On the one hand, we can find the colonial violence, which is rather incorporated in some politically conservative institutions. If I want to name one, we can find, for example, we can find it in the Walid Ben Talal program at Georgetown University, and it is represented by some scholars like John Sposito, Jonathan Wall, and Jonathan Brown. On the other hand, we can find a kind of reactionary violence, which propagates the production of, the knowledge or the indigenous knowledge. And we have briefly talked about some examples that is found in the works of Debashi. If I want to provide my concluding remarks. I think in the end, I think thanks to the speculations of Chakrabarty, Dipesh Chakrabarty, as well as Chakravorty Spivak, we have tried to demonstrate that academic violence, like historical and geographical differences, is inevitable in the status quo. Either the colonial violence or new colonial violence or the reactionary violence. Nonetheless, we may transcend the reactionary and regionalist academic violence by admitting that in the end, we inevitably play in a field that has been plowed over and forever marked by European scholarship. My suggestion is post-colonial, anti-colonial, and subaltern studies can provide us first and foremost with critical answers rather than curative and creative solutions. Critical questions and answers, I can add. It seems that the real virtue of this genealogical approach, if any, lies in the acknowledgement of the predicament. I'd be happy to explain, to elaborate further during the discussion. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you.